Welcome to Bible Direction for Life, the sermon podcast of Westside Baptist Church in Bremerton, Washington. We pray that the preaching and teaching you hear on this podcast connects the truth of the Bible to your life, that you would learn more about the triune God who made you and what he made you for. The following sermon is a part of our summer church preaching series. Each Sunday night during the summer, Westside gathers outdoors to hear sermons from the various preachers in our congregation. Our preacher this time was our music minister, Philemon Rose. His text is John chapter 11.
So if you join me in prayer when we can. Dear Father, we thank you for bringing us to this place where we can see the world that you've made. I thank you for our family that is here today. I thank you for the relationships that we have. I pray that you would strengthen those. I pray that you would strengthen those through your word tonight. I pray that you would be with me, that you would be with my mind. Help me to give what you would have me to give. I pray these things in your name. Amen. So one of the things that I like to do, and this may sound weird, I don't know, but one of the things that I like to do is pay attention to the way that people respond in a time of crisis. And I've come to decide that there's usually about three different categories, or maybe if you add me, a fourth, the guy that's watching everybody. But you have people that just freak out when something really major happens. If somebody is in danger of dying or there's an accident that happens, you have people that just lose their minds and can't do anything. You have people that just step right in and they act. Either they know how to find a first responder, somebody that can do something. They are that themselves and they get right on the problem. Or maybe they see that that is already taken care of, and so we will take care of the crowd. We will keep people from freaking out. And then you also have people that are just frozen. They don't know what to do. They can't even believe that anything is actually happening right then. It doesn't make sense. They think that it must not be real. They can't believe their eyes. Or maybe they're just too scared to do something. But you have three different categories that people typically fall into. But all of those have one thing in common, and that is that they are responding to a situation that requires a response. They may not be responding in a good way, but they are responding. And that's something that we're going to be dealing with tonight. Before we begin, I need to kind of recap where we've been. This is going to be John chapter 11. I forgot to tell you that. John chapter 11, we're going to be starting in verse 17, but before we get there, I need to recap where John chapter 11 has been already. And I've actually preached on this section before, and I'm sure that most of you just remember every word of that, and it was really life-improving, life-changing for you. But for those of you that don't remember, I will recap it. At the end of John chapter 10, Jesus has to leave the region of Judea because the people that are in Judea are incensed at his answer to a question that they asked, even though he answers it directly. It doesn't matter that he actually answers the question that they ask him. They want to stone him when his answer doesn't suit them. Because of this hostility of the Jews in the region around Jerusalem, Jesus leaves the city with his disciples and he goes off to a place that's relatively far away up to the north, where the people are more open and his life isn't in immediate danger right away. Not in danger, at least before the time that his father had determined. And it's here, in this faraway place, that Jesus hears the news that his friend Lazarus, someone the Bible says that Jesus loved specifically, is sick. But when Jesus' disciples hear that Lazarus is sick, they aren't worried because, after all, what is a little sickness to a man that can heal diseases and give sight to the blind? And Jesus himself doesn't seem to be all that worried either because he tells them that Lazarus isn't sick to death, but he's sick for the glory of God. That is the purpose of his sickness. But even if the disciples had known just how sick Lazarus was, they wouldn't have been in that much of a hurry to head back to Jerusalem anyways, because they remembered why they weren't there anymore. They remembered what the Jews had threatened to do to them. Lazarus lived in Bethany, which is just about 2 miles outside of the city of Jerusalem, and that made it the very last place that the disciples wanted to be at. So even after Jesus waits two more days, the disciples are not all that thrilled about heading back to the area of Jerusalem. But Jesus presses on, even through this danger. And that brings us to our text in John chapter 11. John chapter 11 and verse 17. Then when Jesus came, he found that he, this is Lazarus, had lain in the grave 4 days already. Now Bethany was nigh unto Jerusalem, about 15 furlongs off. And many of the Jews came to Martha and Mary to comfort them concerning their brother. Verse 19 tells us that many of the Jews came from the nearby city of Jerusalem to comfort Mary and Martha. And I'll need to touch on that a little bit as we go on, but for now, just keep in mind that there are many Jews that are coming from the city. These are the exact people that Jesus and his disciples had to flee from. This is why they weren't in the area of Jerusalem. And now they are coming to help Martha and Mary in their mourning over their brother Lazarus. This is hostile territory for Jesus. But here he is, anyways. Continuing on in verse 20, then Martha, as soon as she had heard that Jesus was coming, went and met him. But Mary sat still in the house. Then Martha said unto Jesus, Lord, if thou hadst been here, my brother had not died. But I know that even now, whatsoever thou wilt ask of God, God will give it thee. We shouldn't skip past this too quickly. Martha expresses her wish that Jesus had come earlier, and we can certainly understand that. She says this is not because she wanted one more mourner to join the funeral, but because she believes that Jesus could have kept her brother from dying. We might think this is natural to believe, given the things that we've heard in church, the things that we know if we've been reading John up till this point. She has reason to believe that Jesus could do this, but that doesn't take away from the level of faith that's actually required for her to make this statement. Verse 23, Jesus responds to her. Jesus saith unto her, thy brother shall rise again. Martha has just expressed a deep faith in Jesus. But now it seems like Jesus, like many funeral goers both before and after this time, says something pious sounding in order to provide her some comfort, but sometimes that's the way these kinds of things come off, and that's actually seems to be the way that Martha takes it. Verse 24, Martha saith unto him, I know that he shall rise again in the resurrection at the last day. This is a conversation that's actually happened many times at many funerals. Someone, though they're probably certainly well-intentioned, tells a grief-stricken family member that God works all things for good, or that their loved one is in a better place now. And the family member feels the necessity to acknowledge this truth, but they might have the sinking feeling sometimes that they already knew what the person is expressing to them. They might think, I've heard the same sermons that you have. I know the things that you're telling me are true, but I also feel this pain in this moment. I feel this reality. I know I have to say the right things when you tell me this, but I can't feel the things that you're telling me to feel right now. That might be what is going through her mind, and I know it's probably something that goes through other people's mind in times of grief. This is what Martha tells us by saying that I know that he will rise again on the last day, and maybe we could add, but that day is not today. And for now, I feel loss and pain and grief. Miserable comforters, all you all. There's a script that's played out many times, but as we've come to see previous to this, Jesus does not like to follow the scripts that people expect him to read from. He continues on, verse 25. Jesus said unto her, I am the resurrection and the life. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. And whosoever liveth and believeth in me shall never die. Jesus makes an incredible statement here. Martha thought that maybe he was just trying to console her and give her some information that she already knew. That's why she responded the way that she did. She responded the way that she thought she was supposed to. But Jesus goes far beyond her expectations. He's not merely offering a pre-recorded gesture. He takes her existing belief in God. She believes that her brother will rise in the last day. She takes this existing belief and he teaches her that everything she believes has been pointing to something. He takes her from God will raise us up eventually to Jesus, the God-man, will destroy death forever. Jesus says, I am the resurrection and the life. This is not the way that just a mere man speaks. This isn't the way that a mere prophet speaks. Isaiah never said, the glory of me will fill the temple. Daniel never foretold a coming reign of Daniel, the son of man. Jonah did not tell Nineveh, 40 days and yet my wrath will fall upon you, even if he might have felt like that. But Jesus says that he is the resurrection and the life. He's telling Martha, the resurrection that you are putting your faith in is standing right in front of you. This is not the way a mere man speaks. No righteous man would dare to claim that he can do this. And this is why we must believe Jesus for all that he says. We cannot just stop believing that he was a good moral teacher, but that God stuff is just a little bit too far. You cannot have Jesus, the great miracle worker, or Jesus, a man with the approval of God, but just a little crazy on that whole Son of God thing. You cannot go halfway with Jesus. And one reason is because he will not let you. In verse 26, Jesus says, and whosoever liveth and believeth in me shall never die. Believest thou this? Jesus presses the point with Martha, and this is a gracious thing for him to do. He turns her from belief in a far-off resurrection, one that people love to talk about, but maybe even don't actually believe. They just talk about it. He focuses her belief in him and who he is. And we see that she really does believe what he says in her response in verse 27. She saith unto him, yea, Lord, I believe that thou art the Christ, the Son of God, which should come into the world. Martha believes Jesus. She does not just repeat what he tells her. She makes the connection that Jesus is implying with what he says. If he is the resurrection and the life, like he says, if he is the one whose power will raise those who believe in him, then he must be the Messiah that they are waiting for. Jesus has given her hope for her brother because Martha believes that Jesus is who he says he is. After this conversation is over, Martha leaves Jesus to go get Mary. And she had stayed behind in the house with all of the many Jewish mourners that we talked about earlier. Verse 28. And when she had so said, when she had expressed her belief in Jesus, she went her way and called Mary, her sister, secretly, saying, the Master is come and calleth for thee. As soon as she heard that, she arose quickly and came unto him. Now Jesus was not yet come into the town, but was in that place where Martha met him. The Jews then, which were with her in the house, and comforted her, when they saw Mary, that she rose up hastily and went out, followed her, saying, she goeth unto the grave to weep there. Verse 17 told us that there were many Jews that had come from Jerusalem to mourn the death of Lazarus. One of the things that this tells us is that Mary, Martha, and Lazarus' family was relatively well off. They had influence and interactions with the Jews that lived in Jerusalem. That's the only reason that people would come. It's near Jerusalem. It's within 2 miles. But 2 miles is a long way for someone that has to walk. They're going there because they're paying respect to Lazarus. Their family is well off. They have a lot of connections. The death of Lazarus drew many people to come all the way from Jerusalem to be a part of the funeral and the mourning ceremony. But it may not have been all, and it actually probably wasn't all of their friends and family that were coming. Maybe not even just business connections. Because it was customary in those times to hire professional mourners for your funeral. And we actually see that there's a tradition, I believe it was just after the time of Jesus, but it may be something that goes back to then, that even the poorest family was expected to have at least two people to play a flute and one professional mourner whose job it was to cry, "Woe, despair and agony on me!" And that's probably not exactly what they were saying, but I don't read Greek, so. It's not something that we would do in our culture to have professional mourners. It's not something that we would do, and I was making fun of it a little bit, but to have this loud cry, to have these wailings, these despairs, this is what they were paid to do because this is how you showed respect to the dead, at least in that culture. It's not something that they were commanded to do in Scripture, and there might be a little bit of why Jesus responds the way he does. But it was something that was traditional. The job of these professional mourners was to raise a cry, make a noise, and just generally make sure that no one in the town could miss that there was a funeral going on. And this could take place for several days. We've already seen that Lazarus has been dead for 4 days already. Yet the mourners are still there. And when they see Mary get up from inside the house, they think that she must be running off to the gravesite to go cry again. So now they have a job to do. They've got to follow her out. They've got to make a scene. They've got to make a ruckus. So they follow her. And this picture is the scene that we see as we continue on in our text. Mary has heard that Jesus is calling for her. And off she runs, followed by a mob of Jews from Jerusalem, weeping and wailing, playing flutes and yelling after her. Verse 32. Then when Mary was come where Jesus was, and saw him, she fell down at his feet, saying unto him, "Lord, if thou hadst been here, my brother had not died." You cannot listen to this and not imagine what's happening here. Men don't generally like it when women are crying just at any time, but here comes Mary, a woman that Jesus loved. We're told that specifically. He loves her family. He spent time with the family. He's developed relationships with them. They know him well enough that they can reasonably expect that they can call for him multiple days away to tell him that Lazarus is sick and he will come. This woman that Jesus cares for dearly comes running to him with a crowd of screaming, crying people on her heels, falls to her knees in front of him and says, "If only you had been here, my brother would not have died." I'm trying to make you see what's happening here. I want you to feel the emotions that are going on here. This is not just Jesus and Mary. This is Jesus and a distraught woman and a crowd of people that are either real or pretend all mourning at a funeral. I want you to be thinking of this because, as we'll see, this has an effect on Jesus. They may have just run into a notes issue. And then continue on. I want this to affect you. I want you to see what's going on. This can't just be something that you read past. If you're a Christian, you already believe that Jesus is God. You read of the miracles that he performs, and you've heard of the prophecies of his coming. And if you allow yourself to get too used to this idea and just let it flow past you, it can keep you from thinking of Jesus as a man, too. A real human man, armpits and belly button and everything. I've even heard some people say that the temptations of Jesus in the wilderness weren't as much of a temptation as it would be for them in a similar situation. Because Jesus was God. He couldn't fall. He couldn't fail. It wasn't a real temptation. There's no danger of him falling to it. But what we're about to see happen shows that Jesus was just as much a human as you or I, and yet without sin. Look at verse 33. Remember what is happening right now. When Jesus, therefore, saw her weeping, and the Jews also weeping, which came with her, he groaned in the spirit, and was troubled, and said, "Where have ye laid him?" They said unto him, "Lord, come and see." Jesus wept. As Jesus looks around him, He sees a weeping woman on the ground, a crying mob surrounding all of them. He groans in his spirit and is troubled. This phrase in Greek is actually stronger than it comes through in English. You can see that Jesus was moved by what we read, but saying that he is troubled is actually an understatement. The Greek word that has been translated as troubled usually has a sense of anger attached to it. It's used outside the Bible to talk about the snorting of a war horse as it's about to charge into battle. In the other Gospels, Jesus is described with this word when he straightly commands demons to come out of people, when he straightly or strictly commands people not to make word of him as the Messiah known. And in Mark 14, verse 4, when the woman breaks the alabaster box of ointment and begins to wash Jesus' feet, the Pharisees and the others that are there watching are described with the same word that describes Jesus as troubled. They are described as being indignantly murmuring against this woman when they think that she has wasted this wealth. It has a sense of anger to it. Jesus is certainly moved and troubled, but as he looks around at the wailing people around him, he's also angry. But anger is not all that Jesus feels. We've come to the shortest verse in the Bible, and one that maybe, probably even the youngest children here have memorized. As they led Jesus to the tomb of Lazarus, John 11:35 tells us simply that Jesus wept. Why is Jesus angry? Why does Jesus weep? What kind of feeling can touch someone that is just deity in a man shape? Why would Jesus care so much as he sees what is happening around him? He's already told Martha that her brother will rise again. He knows what he's going to do. He's already told his disciples that he's glad that Lazarus has died already. This is previous in chapter 11. He's glad that Lazarus has died because they will see the glory of God come through this situation. He already knows that he's going to raise Lazarus from the dead. So why does he weep? This is the danger that we run into when we do not value what Jesus did as a human man. If we think of Jesus as just a distant spiritual God in the shape of a man, we don't think that he can be affected by the things that happen to us. We think that things must have been so easy for Jesus to do correctly because he couldn't have done anything else. He's God. And when we do this, we take away from the glory of what he's actually done for us. Why would Jesus be angry? Could it be that since he was God, he remembers the perfect unity that he had with his Father back before the world began? Is he thinking back to when he made Adam and Eve, formed them from the dust of the ground, and breathed life into them? Is he thinking of watching his perfect creation refuse to follow his will and fall into sin? Is he thinking of the Godhead's plan to save this fallen creation by sending the very second person of the Trinity down with us to become a man of flesh? Plagiarism has been in the news recently, so I feel like I have to tell you this is not from me. But they've used better words than I can. From the heavens, from undisturbed love, the Son of God came, descending into darkness, taking the humblest form imaginable, a baby in a mother's womb. Dependent in all respects, in his perfect person, walking toward the fire, toward the chaos, toward a world of death, to save. When Jesus hears the laments and the crying, he is face to face, once again, with the entire reason that he came. Death is our greatest foe, and every man, woman, and child in this room will one day face their greatest enemy. Jesus sees the results of sin against God in the death of Lazarus. He sees the futility and loss. He sees the mourning people around him. He sees the pain in the woman on the floor, on the ground at his feet. He sees his enemy flaunting him to his face. But Jesus does not despair, because he knows that he will defeat that enemy. So that's why Jesus is angry. But why does he weep? Jesus weeps because he has become a man, just as much a human as you or I. And he sees the pain around him. He sees the family that he loves so much, that he's had so much interaction with, stricken with pain and suffering. And because he is fully human, and because he loved Lazarus just as much as they did, he weeps just like they did. Jesus is God, and Jesus is man. He was angry with sin, and he was torn by the grief of loss. But because he's the God-man, he can do something about it. And he said, "Where have ye laid him?" They said unto him, "Lord, come and see." And Jesus wept. Verse 36. Then said the Jews, "Behold, how he loved him." And some of them said, "Could not this man, which opened the eyes of the blind, have caused that even this man should not have died?" Jesus therefore again, groaning in himself, is that same word, cometh to the grave. It was a cave, and a stone lay upon it. Jesus said, "Take ye away the stone." Martha, the sister of him that was dead, saith unto him, "Lord, by this time he stinketh, for he hath been dead 4 days." Jesus goes to the tomb. We see that he's moved to anger and to tears, to the point that even those around him can tell. They say, "See how much he loved him." But when he asked them to remove the stone, even Martha, someone he's already had a conversation with just prior to this, talking about how her brother will rise again, how she believed that he is the resurrection and the life, even Martha still doesn't truly, fully believe the ramifications of that. But Jesus keeps on, verse 40. Jesus saith unto her, "Said I not unto thee that if thou wouldst believe, thou shouldest see the glory of God?" Then they took away the stone from the place where the dead was laid. Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, "Father, I thank thee that thou hast heard me. And I knew that thou hearest me always, but because of the people which stand by, I said it, that they may believe that thou hast sent me." When he thus had spoken, he cried with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come forth." Now, I don't know how long the words of Jesus hung in the air. I don't know what those around him were thinking. Maybe they thought Jesus had gone a little bit too far out in the skinny branches. Maybe Martha was ready to pull Jesus aside and say, "It was a good thought, but I don't want you to embarrass yourself." Maybe the hired mourners all around him were about to start laughing at Jesus. And all of that stopped when a dead man walked out of the grave. And when he had thus spoken, he cried with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come forth." And he that was dead came forth, bound hand and foot with grave clothes, and his face was bound about with a napkin. Jesus saith unto them, "Loose him, and let him go." Then many of the Jews, which came to Mary, and had seen the things which Jesus did, believed on him. But some of them went their ways to the Pharisees, and told them what things Jesus had done. Then gathered the chief priests and the Pharisees a council, and said, "What do we? For this man doeth many miracles. If we let him thus alone, all men will believe on him. And the Romans shall come and take away both our place and nation." And one of them, named Caiaphas, being the high priest that same year, said unto them, "Ye know nothing at all, nor consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people, and that the whole nation perish not. And this spake he not of himself, or not of his own volition, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus should die for that nation. And not for that nation only, but that also he should gather together in one the children of God that were scattered abroad." Then from that day forth, they took counsel together for to put him to death. I don't have time to go into everything that I could in Caiaphas' prophecy. There's certainly a lot of things that could be said here, and I'm sure Pastor Peter would be saying, wait, stop, slow down. But what stands out to me here, what I will focus on, is that Caiaphas is berating the rest of the Sanhedrin for not thinking about the logical, obvious solution to their problem. They're complaining about how if they let Jesus keep doing what he's doing, everyone will follow after him, and the Romans won't let them be in charge anymore. And Caiaphas says the answer is obvious. What's wrong with all of you? We need to kill him. Now, let's put aside the moral dilemma that this brings up. This is the people that are supposed to be leading spiritually the entire people of Israel. These are their spiritual leaders. And the first thing that they think of to fix their problem is that they need to kill an innocent man. That's an option. And it's not only an option, it's the most desirable option. Let's only think about the logic for a second. This man can raise dead people to life. We need to kill him. Now, maybe the Sanhedrin didn't hear all the context. They probably wouldn't have listened to everything, even if their informants told them about every conversation that happened, even if they told them that Jesus had claimed to be the resurrection and the life. They probably wouldn't have believed it. We've already seen that they've looked past many things like this already. But we do know what happened. Jesus told us here that he is the resurrection and the life. And we know that means that he is not just a mere man, but the very Son of God, because only the Son of God can claim to raise people from the dead, to be the resurrection, to be the life. We've seen also that just as Jesus was fully God, he was also fully man. He came down and became one of us. And we'll turn to Hebrews chapter 4 real quickly. Or less quickly. Hebrews chapter 4, verse 14. Seeing then that we have a great high priest that is passed into the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our profession. For we have not a high priest which cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities, but was in all points tempted, like as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore come boldly unto the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. The next chapter, 5, verse 7, who in the days of his flesh, still talking about Jesus, when he had offered up prayers and supplications with strong crying and tears unto him that was able to save him from death, and was heard in that he feared, though he were a son, yet learned he obedience by the things which he suffered. And being made perfect, he became the author of eternal salvation unto all them that obey him. Jesus became fully man. He suffered the same things that we do and lived in the strife and the despair of a sin-filled world so that he could become our great high priest. He was just as much a man as he was God. That is mind-boggling. I don't know how to square that. All I can tell you is that that's what it says. I can try. I could probably talk for a long while and just confuse a bunch of you. But I can tell you that it is true. Jesus was a man. Jesus was God. He says he is the resurrection and the life, and he cried, wept tears, and was angry at what death was doing to those that he loved. And he came into that anyway. But we've seen that not everyone responds in a rational way, even if they think that they're being logical. The Sanhedrin think that they should kill the author of life. They think that they can do something to protect themselves by killing this man that has already raised someone from the dead. Not everyone responds to the same situation in the same way. But there is only one way that we can respond to this. Jesus is the God-man. That is what we proclaim. He is Lord of heaven, Lord of earth. All authority on heaven and on earth has been given unto him. It's only logical that we follow after him. But not everyone responds to that. You can see, you can feel what is happening in the world around us today. You can see how a nation that has been running on the last dregs of blessings from a Christian founding is sputtering to a stop and about to go into a free-for-all. And that's just here. That's not the rest of the things that we hear about going on in the world. These people around us are rebelling against their God. They're rebelling against the one that made them, and it will not end well. But I'm not talking to those people right now. You that are under the sound of my voice, probably everyone here, at least claims to be a Christian, and that's a good thing. I'm glad that you're here. I'm glad that you would make that claim for yourself. And if you don't, then I'm glad to have you here. I'm glad that you're listening. But everyone that is here has heard the truth. Everyone that has been coming to church all their life, or even for the past few months, whatever it is, I hope that you have heard the truth that Jesus is God, that he was man, that he is a man, and that he is the one that all the world will bow down to. All of you have heard that, but yet every one of us can think of someone that we know that used to be here that isn't anymore. I feel for you young people, and I kind of have to smile saying that because to all the 50-year-olds, it's so cute that I'm growing up. And to all the teenagers and 12-year-olds here, you like to ask me what it was like rubbing elbows with Methuselah. But I'm kind of in that middle period. But as I look around at the things that are happening now, I fear for the young people in our church and all around us. Because this is the time when everyone wants to be accepted by the world. This is a time of life when it means the most to you to be doing the cool thing, to be in with the in crowd. And that is not possible any longer. There used to be a Christian aura in the world around you that even if you were just moral, the morals that come from Christianity, that was just like I believe it was Brother Josh this morning was saying, that used to give you a benefit, and now it's a detraction. You will not be able to coast through life. It's not just the young people, everyone here. You will be seen as immoral if you follow after Jesus. We can all think of people that are not here any longer that used to be. And all of this has been to issue a warning to you. Because it is so easy to follow after other things. Maybe even you don't think that you are. So what I hope I've shared with you today is just the importance of following after the King, following after the one who has conquered life, the one who has conquered death. Because it does not make sense, and right now would be the worst time to leave, chase after something else, and then to come to the end of everything. It will not matter when the final judge makes the final verdict what the guy on TikTok said that made fun of Christianity. It will not matter what group that you weren't allowed to get into at the end of time. Jesus is the resurrection and the life. Everyone must follow after him. I pray that you would do that today, that you would do that as we continue. and that that would be on your mind as we continue throughout the rest of whatever is to come. Dear Lord, I thank you for this people. I pray for those around me. I pray for myself. It is so easy to be tempted by other things. The people that were with you, that saw what you did, sometimes it didn't matter. They just chased after their own things. I pray that you would guard us. I pray that if anyone here is questioning, that they've seen an argument that they think is irrefutable, or if they have a doubt that hasn't been answered, I pray that they would seek an answer. We know that we can trust you. We thank you for the life that you bring. We thank you for the resurrection that you work in people that we have thought were a lost cause. We thank you for the resurrection that you have worked in each and every one of us in even making us seek your face. I pray that we would seek that life, that we would seek you. Pray these things in your name. Amen.
Thank you for listening to this message. If you would like to learn more about the Westside Baptist Church, please visit our website, www.BibleDirectionForLife.com. Subscribe to the podcast if you would like to hear new sermons and lessons each week. And remember that a sermon podcast is no substitute for opening up a Bible and reading for yourself. Thank you.